Welcome to our program. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. And we come your way every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific Time. We broadcast live, stream live on richarddugan.com. And we archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page. So I encourage you to tune in every Saturday. I encourage you to go to our archives and take a look at the, I think we're in the neighborhood, we're fast approaching 200 programs on the website, so you have a wide and diverse selection to choose from. And we encourage you to stay tuned to this program, because this is going to be a very fascinating program as well, as we are set to talk with our special guest for this broadcast, Erica Miner. She's an author, she's a screenwriter, as well as a lecturer. As a matter of fact, as we speak, she's coming off a long lecture from the evening before. She's also, I don't know whether this is self-imposed or somebody gave you this title, a journaling queen. Welcome to our program, Erica.
Thank you so much, Richard.
Now, I also understand from reading the information that that you have on your website that you were a classical violinist.
I was indeed for most of my life, and I was at the Metropolitan Opera playing violin for 21 years.
And you began your career, as most of us might if we're into music, as a child. I remember learning the violin, the piano. I even learned how to play the accordion, the baritone in high school. Do I know how to play any of those today? No. But you started out as a child?
I started out as a child, but actually, by the time I played the violin, I was already 9 years old, which is fairly late for that. But before that, I actually started out singing, then dancing, then writing, strangely enough, and then I got to the violin. So kind of hitting all the bases there.
But very musically inclined, and I don't know why, for some reason I'm thinking, so are you telling me that a violinist peaks at the age of nine?
No, not at all. Quite the contrary. It's just usually, it's such a difficult instrument that it's more common for a kid to start the violin more like at age four or five. So nine is relatively late, but I made up a lot of lost time.
Well, now I don't feel so bad for not continuing. If it's it wasn't that easy. I did learn the ultimate song for a single-digit child. I did learn, I think it was Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. That's about as far as my violin career went. But you pursued this. It was your life's passion?
It was indeed my passion. Actually, my father was my first violin teacher. So I had music from both my parents, music in the household ever since I can remember. So it seemed predestined that I would be a violinist.
So you, I guess I want to get an idea of what music meant to you during those days, especially as you began to perform in front of larger and larger audiences with symphony orchestras and so forth?
Music, I can say, pretty much meant everything to me. My whole life revolved around it. I practiced every day, and on weekends I went to orchestra rehearsals. I grew up in Detroit, and I went to the All City junior orchestra rehearsals, and then in high school I went to a high school that specialized in music and arts and sciences, and I did music pretty much all day long, every day, and even in the evenings and performances. So I was completely, completely immersed in it, loved it, was passionate about it.
What did it do for you?
Music, I mean, as much as you can say about it when you're that young, it felt like it fed my soul. Mm. It really fed my soul. There was such a love for it. My parents used to take me to concerts all the time, and that made a huge impression on me, because that music, and classical music for the most part, is pretty much stamped on my brain forever, but also in my soul. I just felt it all resonated with me so dramatically that even to this day, 100 years later, I still feel those same feelings that I felt way back then when I heard this music. It just was everything to me. Even my best friends were all musicians. I was just steeped in it.
And then something happened that changed all that sort of took away the passion that you had in your life?
Well, it didn't take away the passion, but it took away the ability to be able to do music, and that was after going through high school and college, studying music and being immersed in it. I actually got a position at the Metropolitan Opera in New York, playing violin in the orchestra, and I did that for, as I mentioned, 21 years, and towards the end of that time, there was a life-altering experience. When I was driving home from a rehearsal one day, a guy in a speeding car crashed into me, and the injuries that I got from that accident never fully healed, and after a year and a half of physical therapy, while still trying, you know, being expected to perform my musical duties at the Met, I finally just had to give up my professional musical career. It was too painful.
Physically?
Mm-hmm.
How did that, I mean, that must have been just devastating when you had to make that choice. If it had been instantaneous where my career is over from the moment of that accident, that would have been one thing. But you went through this long therapeutic process to come to that point.
Indeed, I did. It was, as you said, it was painful physically, but also psychologically and emotionally. That you don't give up that job lightly. It's very difficult, very competitive to get into the Met Orchestra, and it's a great job. It's very prestigious. It's also very difficult. Scheduling is, you know, these operas are anywhere from 3 to 4 to even 6 hours long. So it's grueling, but it's still really rewarding, and to have to give that up, you don't do it lightly. You know, it was a long process of thinking and discussing and weighing all my options and trying to just somehow keep at it, and eventually the writing was just on the wall. I just couldn't do it anymore.
That's an interesting turn of the phrase, because that's, in essence, what you turned to. It was another one of your passions, and that was writing.
Exactly. And as I mentioned before, I actually started writing before I started playing the violin.
Mm-hmm.
Back then in Detroit, there was actually money in the schools for extra programs. And for some reason, I was placed in an after-school program for creative writing. Some teacher must have seen a spark of some sort. And I remember just loving the process. I was about 7 years old at the time. And it was just, to me, almost as rewarding as music. In fact, I often combine the two, writing about music. It's just, you know, I get to put my two passions together. But at an early age, I just started developing this love for the process of writing. And it was always there. So somehow I managed to reach down and bring it back to the surface, and I've been doing it ever since.
And you have 3 books that I have seen here available through your website: Murder in the Pit, Forever Friends, and Travels with My Lovers. Now, these are all fiction?
They're all fiction, but they're somewhat based, actually all 3 of them have certain base in reality.
Mm-hmm.
Certain autobiographical elements. But yes, they're fiction. Only the author knows for sure what parts are fiction and what are not.
And all names have been changed, but you don't know whether they have or not. That being the reader.
You know, it happens often in fiction when you base it on your own experience and they say, write what you know. But certain characters, and I've been asked this quite a bit, certain characters are like combinations of people. You know, there are different elements of different people that I met over the years, and I kind of combine them. So any one character is just based on any one person. It's kind of a combination of characteristics, intriguing ones, especially those that I met at the Met, these characteristics of people that kind of all came together in the characters that I created and developed in my fiction.
Now, I know a lot of our guests often talk about using journaling to work through whatever events, challenges, what have you, happen in their lives. Is that something that you also do?
I have, yes. In the past, it's especially. I actually write a journaling column for the National Association of Baby Boomer Women, NABBW. I have a monthly column with them in which I discuss certain aspects of journaling and give hints on how to motivate yourself and different exercises and journaling and that sort of thing. So I've always been a big believer in journaling. I actually started it when I was in high school, of all things, because I was so excited at the prospect of this new episode in my life, and I started journaling then, and I've pretty much been doing it on and off ever since. And in fact, those journals that I wrote in high school formed the basis for my second book, Forever Friends. So as a writer, journaling is extremely valuable because you have like a gold mine of information and grist for your mill. You never know when you can use some of that material in your writing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think mostly it's just important as a great therapy to be able to get your thoughts and feelings out of your head and onto the page. And in certain crisis points in my life, it really has basically saved my life.
Well, I know that even I have all of these wonderful little ideas in my head, and in high school, even in college, and I only went to a junior college for 3 semesters because I remember, you know, the old, what do you want to do when you grow up? It's like, well, I don't know. And I was asked that question even in high school. I was asked that question as I was going through junior college, and I still didn't know. And then suddenly certain events happened, and boom, there I was. I always seemed to be at the right place at the right time. But I loved that the art of writing as well, because nobody could tell you whether it was right or wrong. You know, if you were journaling, they're your experiences. Nobody can nullify or devalue those. Critics can, but they're your experiences.
Well, yeah, that's the beauty of journaling. If you choose to share it with someone, you can. But mostly, it's just your own private little world, just for you.
How did this whole series of events in your life that transformed you from a professional violinist to a more professional writer? And you seem to have been blessed with sort of 2 passions, the violin, music, I should say, more of a broad term, and writing. And so you at least you had one to fall back on, and not everybody has that. But how did that change you on the inside, on a deeper level, more of a spiritual level? I mean, where were you before? Did you give up on God or that, you know, this is my fate as opposed to some other perspective?
I never gave up on anything, really. I mean, music is still a major part of my life. But the difficulty was admitting that I wasn't going to be able to keep up what I had been doing, which I thought I'd be doing for the rest of my life. It seemed just, I know for you, you said it was, you know, you had some kind of fits and starts until you found your niche.
Yeah.
For me, it seemed like from the very beginning, I was just going to be playing the violin for the rest of my life. And all of a sudden, you know, in a split second, that possibility disappeared. It was just taken away. So I had to go through a very deep grieving process over that, and in some ways, I'm still going through it. You kind of never completely get over something that was such a huge part of your life, but I do feel blessed in that I, as you said, I had something to fall back on, and not just anything, but something that had always been a passion, and in fact, I kept taking writing classes whenever I could, even when I was at the Met, because I had this passion, this drive to tell stories. So I feel really lucky. I'm on a different path now, but it's still a path of creativity. It's a path that is very important for me, and it's gratifying for me, but also I get to reach out to other people, motivate other people and inspire them and tell stories that they enjoy. And what could be better than that?
I couldn't agree with you more on that. Let me ask you, when you're talking with people or even amongst your family and your friends, when, especially now, and I understand you say you're still sort of going through the grieving process and it doesn't really end. It might diminish a little over time, but it's always there. Do you still get those sounds in the audience or from people when you say, I was this and then this happened, oh my gosh, kind of a reaction? And it's like, well, yeah, but it's not a big deal because look what I'm doing now. As you've said, what could be better? I'm still doing one of my passions, and it's a wonderful thing, and music is still a part of my life. Do you get those reactions from people of the aghast, oh, my heavens, what a terrible thing?
Oh, absolutely, all the time. And most people's reactions are extremely sympathetic, and that to me is gratifying because there's an understanding mm-hmm. of what I've been through. So, I'm kind of over that, mm-hmm. you know. It's like, yes, there's a reaction. Yes, people are sympathetic, and it is shocking and that sort of thing. But right now, I'm in my passion for writing and for lecturing. And like the lecture that I gave last night, which was about opera, and everybody was just so, as a combination of entertained and educated, mm-hmm. what I like to do in my lectures. You know, they learn, they enjoy, and to me, I'm able to communicate in that way, whereas before I communicated with my violin playing other people's music, now I communicate from deep within my soul about my feelings, my deep love and passion for music. I communicate that to the people in the audiences, and they really get it. I love to watch the smiles on their faces, and it's all original thought and original emotions coming from deep within my soul that about this music that I love so dearly, and I'm able to communicate that through speech instead of through musical notes. But all in all, it's about communication with people through a creative process that they all identify with and relate to, and it's really gratifying. I love it. It makes me feel great. It makes me feel like, you know, I'm on the right path.
Ah, and that's a good feeling, too. I know.
Yeah, very important to be on the right path.
When we come back, I've got some questions regarding performing of this music. I voice commercials for a local classical station, and I'm learning several different languages all at the same time, whether it be the names of the composers, the names of the pieces, or the names of the instruments, and so forth. So it's a fascinating experience for me. But I want to talk to you about interpretation when we come back. We're talking with Erica Miner, and she is an author, a writer, she's a lecturer, as she has just mentioned, and this is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. Stay right where you are.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and this is our segment where we talk with Beth McDonald. I like to refer to her as our AAA editor, our astrological and astronomical assignment editor, and we're going to talk a little bit about what's happening in the world as it relates to the events of the planets and so forth. But before we do that, I'm going to mention to you a couple of films I think you might be interested in seeing. They're coming up the 9th at Yoga Soup here in Santa Barbara, called The Spirit Molecule. Basically, you're going to want to get more information. It's Within Us All, The Spirit Molecule Within Us All, again at Yoga Soup, 7:30 p.m. And you can go to hopedance.org and click on the events page. You get all the information, all the particulars. Usually there's a small donation of $8 or $10 or $12, very nominal, especially for what you get. And then on the 23rd of May, also at Yoga Soup, Vine of the Soul, Encounters with Ayahuasca. Ayahuasca, it's a film by Richard Meach, if any of that means anything to you. So I encourage you to check those out. Go to hopedance.org, click on the events page, and you can get all the particulars about the different movies that are coming out. Now, there is a movie that is available for viewing, having to do with something that we're going to be talking about in the near future. And it has to do with a group of 13 women. They're elders from the four corners of the earth. They are the 13 indigenous grandmothers, and they are basically weaving a world that works. Fascinating. I've seen a lot of the videos online at YouTube, and if you'd like to check that out as well, there's a movie that was shown here locally. I'm sure it's going to be shown again. It's called For the Next Seven Generations. So check that out. Good stuff, far better than anything you're going to see in any of the movie theaters, I do say. Right now, far better than anything that we can guess at, we're going to talk with Beth McDonald now about what in the world is going on. We're going to talk a little bit about our families and community, which is sort of what these grandmothers are helping us through, and also talking about service above self. And again, that also speaks to what these 13 women are doing coming together. And I have to say, Beth, that growing up in a family of eight with four sisters, two older, two younger, I really wouldn't have a real problem with living under a matriarchal society. So, I'm ready for that.
You're ready. Yeah. Well, you're one in a million. You know, it's rare.
Yeah.
It's rare, but there's just times in these astrological cycles where everything comes back home, and this is one of them. Granted, there's a lot of energy in Aries, which is considered, it is a male sign, but Aries is primarily the innovator and the pioneer and the one who finds the new way. And what I'm seeing so much in my practice right now, now that Easter's over and tax season is over and we're kind of regrouping, it's a lot of things are coming back home. A lot of people are coming back home. There's a lot of emphasis on home and family, extended family, community, working together to solve our common problems. This week I'm suddenly seeing, more divorces again, and Uncle Joe lost his job, and so and so just got diagnosed with a medical condition, which is going to bring a hardship on the family. And so, there's a lot of patterns and trends that I see in my job. And right now, all roads lead home. And so, and home can be such a blessing, because when it's working, nobody nourishes us and feeds our souls like our families do.
Mm-hmm.
But on a trickier day, it's a lot of work. It is service. You have to put the good of the whole sometimes above your own immediate needs, for a family to work.
And that's not saying that you put the good of the whole to putting yourself aside.
Right.
This is not about denying self. It's about at this point in time, for this period.
For this period.
Let's focus on the good of the whole.
Right.
You can get back to yourself, in a week or two, or whatever the time frame is.
Right. And it gets a little political at times, and everybody's different. But the model I like to use, I have a dear client. Her family has a mission statement. And the mission statement of this family is, we are a democratic family where we work together to make sure everybody gets their needs met.
Okay.
And it was the most crystalline thing I have ever seen a matriarch walk into my office and say, and it is so powerful. That is the model that all of us aspire to. It's not easy on a good day. It's not easy on a good day, but the idea is, with give and take, with compromise and negotiations, in general, we are committed to everybody getting their needs met in this family, knowing that not everybody's going to be 100% happy every minute of every day.
Right, right.
But that's the goal we are aspiring to, and it's just a magical thing.
But isn't it also my own personal experience and awareness that the women in particular within families, within extended families especially, and not to be flippant and throw stereotypes out there, but haven't women really been the backbone? Haven't they been the ones, so to speak, calling the shots all the time anyway? And again, I'm actually looking at that and saying that from the standpoint, in all seriousness, from the dynamics that we have in our world.
Well, I, to a certain degree, yes, in that you manifest what you are intending. But if women wielded as much power, women would not be paid 75 cents on a dollar to a man. You know, it would still not be quite such a man's world. You know, women are still struggling, I think, to figure out, you know, what's fair, what's right, how do we use our power appropriately. You know, so many women, you know, kind of suffer silently or martyr themselves and never really live the kind of full or fulfilled lives. They're always sacrificing for their children and their elderly parents and their husband's career and whatever. I mean, we're kind of taught that we have to be, you know, we have to be the backbone, but it's the backbone, you know, at our expense. And so I do believe, I agree with you, that model is changing.
Yeah.
But it's often the most difficult for women to realize that, you know, they have to be the change they want to see in the world. It begins with us. It begins with me.
And I know that there was a line, and this is going back to what I saw last night on YouTube as far as these 13 indigenous grandmothers. And there was a quote that was put in there that the only way that we're going to change the world is if we change. Then
right.
There was the equivalent of a long pause or a quadruple spacing.
Yeah.
And then at the bottom in the far lower right-hand corner, it said, all of us.
Right.
And it got me to thinking about how I played this one game in a program that I went through back in the 80s. It was called Lifeboat, and you had to vote people off. And you had to sort of figure out, okay, well, why am I voting this person off? I mean, they're a human being and blah, blah, blah. Well, this is the reverse of that. This is a lifeboat, and we are saying to everyone, please, please come on board. You know, the old ways aren't working anymore. Let those go. Please, we want you on board this lifeboat.
Yeah.
That's really what's being said these days.
Yeah. Yeah, and we value your contribution.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody
exactly.
contributes.
Exactly.
Everybody has something magical and useful, utilitarian, to contribute to this process. You know, it's just about how do we work together to maximize what we have to work with here.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the time out today to share with us this information, and people can get in touch with you through BethMcDonaldConsulting.com.
Yes.
And they can call you?
At 963-0842, and that's in the 805 area code.
All right. And we encourage you to get in touch with Beth. If you have questions, you can go to her website. You can send her an email. You can phone her. We've given you the number. And certainly she's been on the program. I can't remember if you've been on once or twice, but as far as a long interview, long form interview.
Right. Twice now. Twice.
So
yeah.
Her interviews are there. And of course, we're linked to her website as well. So
yes.
We encourage you to check out BethMcDonaldConsulting.com. Beth, thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard. Talk to you next time.
And we'll be back with more on Tell Me Your Story in just a moment. I'm Richard Dugan. Stay tuned.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
And Tell Me Your Story is the program. We're here every Saturday, 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time, except during the month of May 2011 when it's 7 p.m. And we are archiving on the internet at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page, and we encourage you to go there and listen. Go to our schedules page. See who we have coming up in the coming weeks and months. Sometimes I get way ahead of myself for scheduling, and then there are times when I like to kind of do it week at a time, and both ways are kind of fun as well. We're talking with Erica Miner, and she has a website. It's ericaminer.com, and she has three books that are presently available on her site, and she is also a screenplay writer. I want to talk a little bit about that, but I want to go back to the music and performing. I've always had this curiosity, Erica, and we have a beautiful symphony here in Santa Barbara that plays and performs at a marvelous venue called the Granada. And the question that has always perplexed me, you have a composer, and it doesn't matter whether they're modern day or people like Mozart or Beethoven or what have you. And they have this idea, they have this vision for this piece. And they hear it in their heads and they write it down and they put it all together on paper. They write all the notes and so forth. Then you have the conductor who stands before the orchestra and is going to lead the musicians in this piece. Then you have the performers, such as yourself, who read the music and then they play it. But they're also following the lead of the conductor. All three elements are all about interpretation. But the only one that really matters from one perspective is the composer, the one who wrote it. It's like when you write from your heart, you wrote those words and you meant what you said and you said what you meant, right? So there is really no room for interpretation, right?
Wow, that's kind of a multi-level question.
Well, the question comes down to this. How do you look at a piece of music and play it when you have a particular style and interpretation? The conductor has a different style and interpretation of leading, and the composer has a different style and interpretation when he wrote it. How do you bring all of that together as a performer to present it in the way, say, that the composer intended?
That's a really interesting question, and even the question itself is open to interpretation. But in my experience, and again, I started playing in orchestras when I was 10 years old, so it's very deeply ingrained in my soul, that kind of ensemble playing. When you play in an ensemble, whether it's, you know, 10 people or 50 or 100 people, you automatically give yourself in to be the greater good, as it were. So whatever feelings you have about a Mozart symphony that you may be playing or an overture, those feelings and your own interpretations take a back seat to what the conductor sees as how he or she wants to interpret a certain piece. So you combine your own experience with having listened to it, having played it on your own, and with the conductor's experience of having studied the whole score, and most good conductors know exactly what every instrument is playing at any given time, and the conductor takes that knowledge and from it gathers an interpretation of how he or she thinks it should be performed. So you're giving over your own feelings about the music to, and your trust into, someone who hopefully, not always, but usually, has studied the piece and knows every note of every part of the orchestra. You're giving your trust over to that person and allowing yourself to interpret according to what that person is asking for, and the person is asking for what he or she has seen and felt from the composer's music. So all that to say, to me, playing in an ensemble orchestra, chamber orchestra, even a string quartet, you're combining your own personal feelings about the music with those of other people, and in an orchestra you're putting your trust in the conductor to not only interpret the music, but of course to keep everything together.
Mm-hmm.
So a conductor has a very difficult job, to say the least. And it's a very gratifying kind of experience, because if it does come together and everybody plays in sync and in harmony with each other, there's no greater feeling. As much as I love solo playing and string quartets, there's no more euphoric feeling than being part of a big orchestra playing a great work of music, Beethoven's Ninth or any of those pieces that have stood the test of time in the minds and hearts of people who have been listening to those pieces.
Mm-hmm.
To play that in an orchestra and to give your trust over to the conductor, who hopefully is going to interpret the music and make it resonate with all of the musicians and all of the people in the audience, that's a truly great experience. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense, and it sort of leads into where I'd like to sort of transport us forward, using that same philosophy in relation to the way in which we live our lives, this program is sort of devoted to the whole aspect of bringing new ideas to the table, new paradigms for a new world. We want to create a new world, a better world. Many of us, and the number is growing, are really quite dissatisfied with the way things are. We also have to acknowledge that we've kind of created all of this in a manner of speaking. And so we want to talk with different people who have different ideas, who have different ways of viewing their lives and the way that they live their lives and the areas where it's working really well and the areas it's not, they're working on making it work well. And I think about your explanation of the way in which a symphony or any musical group operates is almost the way in which nature and or the universe operates. There is no questioning. There is no debating. There is no one star, one voice situation. It's they're spinning and doing their thing because it's what they do, and however it turns out is how it turns out. Not exactly fate per se, but it's like getting into the flow, getting into the zone in the sports terminology. Has that helped you, that training, in terms of playing within a symphony or in an orchestra, a large ensemble, helped you in terms of moving forward and writing? Because, yes, you're writing. You're a solo writer. You have all of these books and screenplays. They're your words, but you're still just part of the whole.
Yes, I do feel that way. I mean, it's, you know, nothing happens in a vacuum. No person is an island. It's really, I mean, if you, you know, played the violin and nobody ever heard you, or if you wrote a book and no one ever read it, then you're not quite making the most of your gift and of what you have to offer to other people. I mean, I truly believe that we're on this planet to help other people.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really, ultimately, that's my own personal philosophy. And so you can't keep something like that to yourself if you have a gift that, you know, something to offer to the rest of the world, then it's kind of your responsibility to be able to give that aspect of yourself over to other people who will benefit from it. And, you know, it's a two-way street, too. Mm-hmm. You can get benefit from other people who have things to offer, and that's how we ultimately help ourselves. When it comes to music, a lot of, over the centuries, over the millennia, a lot of civilizations, like, for instance, the Greeks, felt that music was the most noble of all the arts. Many civilizations felt that way because of the purity of the form.
Uh-huh.
And the purity of the emotions that it elicits. You know, you just listen to a melody like, you know, the Beethoven's Ode to Joy, you can't not react to that.
Yeah.
It's a universal reaction. And that's something that, you know, Beethoven was put on this earth with a gift that he offered to mankind, to humankind. And we all have, we may not be geniuses like Beethoven, but we all have our gifts. We all have something to offer, and in my case, I have my stories and my music, and it's gratifying to me. I'm not going to sit here and write my stories and keep it to myself. I can't. I really want to offer it up.
Mm-hmm. Let me sort of dive into that just a little bit more, too, because I think that what you say is very profound coming from where you come from. So I would put the question to you, and though you have sort of answered the question, I'm going to ask the question directly, and that is, what does Erica Minor have to offer?
Oh, let me think. Just such a thought-provoking question. I mean, you know, the short answer is a lot. I mean, as I mentioned, I've had a lifetime of experiences, a lot of which no one else ever has. You know, not very many people get to perform at the world's most prestigious opera house and rub shoulders with all these stars who are revered by so many thousands of people. To be able to interpret the music that I love so dearly and offer that up to people who appreciate and enjoy it, to be able to write about these experiences in a way that people can relate to and identify with, I think that's what I have to offer. It's my experience, it's my knowledge, and it's really my soul.
Mm-hmm.
I have things in my soul that I feel very passionate about, and that's what I have to offer and to give. And fortunately, I've gotten a lot of recognition and feedback from people who appreciate that and who benefit from that. And that's really the essence of it. That's what I have to offer, and I'm really happy about it.
You've expressed also your love for music. It's an integral part of who Erica Miner is, even though you're not performing these days. And I've been working to put together a couple of programs dealing with music and sound therapy. I've heard of this, what they refer to as the Mozart effect, and we heard the reports about how classical music, or the studies, how classical music, you know, affects the brain in such a way as to stimulate certain parts of the brain, and that certain composers' pieces affect the brain in different ways, and so forth and so on. So I'm wondering, from your perspective, the role that music plays, especially in light of our educational system. I know that you've seen many news reports and pieces on individuals who are out there and encouraging young people to become more interested in and become passionate about not just classical music, but all types of music, including opera, which, by the way, is probably one of the most difficult and or misunderstood forms of music that there is right now.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you brought up the whole subject of the young people and the generations to come,
mm-hmm.
because really, that's what it's all about, as far as, first of all, audiences. But beyond that, the benefits, you know, civilization can benefit from a generation of people or more generations of young people who grow up to appreciate music. They can enrich their lives. They can enrich the lives of their own children, and hopefully it will go on and on. And I think that the thing about young people, and I've done a lot of seminars in schools, and as a matter of fact, when I was at the Met, I used to do opera seminars with the kids at my daughter's elementary school, and I even was able to take groups of them to rehearsals at the Met, and I can't begin to tell you how they responded to that. A kid is a clean slate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like they're like sponges. They're open to everything. They can absorb everything. And when they get the opportunity to listen to music like opera at the age of 8 or 9 or 7 or whatever, then that's ingrained in their psyche for the rest of their lives. So whenever, I mean, yes, maybe they're not opera lovers, but whenever they hear opera, if they've been exposed to it in an early age, then it's something that will always be part of their soul. And this is the thing about Leonard Bernstein's young people's concerts that was so valuable, because a whole generation of kids, and I know I used to watch them on TV when I was a kid,
mm-hmm.
and a whole generation of kids, and by the way, I used to be so jealous of the kids who actually were in New York and able to see him live, and I did have the opportunity to work with him many times once I became a professional musician. But as a kid, oh, it was incredible. He opened our eyes, he opened our ears, he gave us such knowledge and such insight, and he spoke to kids on a level that we could all relate to. And I think that he really created a generation of grown-ups who had this wonderful experience of listening to and watch music and watching orchestras perform music. at a very young age when they're so impressionable, I think that stays with you for life. And so I think it's so important if we're going to be able to continue to give people the benefit of classical music. I think the key is to start them young, start having them listen to it at an early age, bring them to performances, to young people's concerts, to anything that will grab their attention and make an impression, because before you know it, they will have something so valuable to keep with them for their entire lives. And so I think that keeping the young generation as part of this paradigm of the appreciation of music, it's really the key to everything, because young people are the key to the future.
Indeed. And two experiences that I had, one back in my childhood growing up, there was an element of our music class that was called music memory. And what it was about was learning to memorize, if you will, the different pieces and who the composer was, the name of the piece, and so forth. So when you heard it, you could identify it, and you became familiar with it. And if you were able to do this at the end of the term, then you were able to go to, and of course I was born and raised in Phoenix, Arizona, so you were able to go to Grady Gamage Auditorium and listen to these pieces being played in an incredibly acoustically designed facility. And it was wonderful, not just to get out of class, but to hear these pieces. And then the most recent was here in Santa Barbara at the Granada Theater, where I heard a piece I had never heard of before, let alone heard of the composer. It was, I believe, if I'm correct, Mahler's Fifth Symphony. And if that's the correct, I believe that's the correct composer, it's one of the most, as I observed it, the most frenetic pieces of music and schizophrenic that I had ever heard, until I understood more because they shared with us the background of Mahler and how this came to be. And it just blew me away. I remember hearing from the violin section, one person that I knew from that section said that, oh yeah, the violinists refer to it as Mahler's Hurt Locker, because they have to play so many notes so fast, it's just unbelievable. That, for me, going to musical events like symphonies, present performances such as this, I love that. Whether I understand what's actually happening or I have the background information, it does something to me. And that's where I'm coming from in terms of better understanding the effect of music on the human being, the body, mind, soul, and spirit. Obviously, as a performer, you're sitting there and you're bombarded from all sides because you're right there in the middle of it all. That's got to be just incredible.
It's beyond incredible. Like I said, there's nothing like being in an orchestra, like performing with an orchestra. It's just huge, and I can totally relate to what you say about Mahler, because Mahler is just, everything about his music just blows you away.
Well, I did hear somebody say, "What drugs was he taking when he wrote that?"
Yeah.
Wow, what a piece!
What a piece, and it's only one of many.
Yeah.
Of his pieces, but yeah, I totally agree that there's nothing like live performance.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what it comes down to, and when people say, you know, music is, it's not necessary, that's just so way off the mark. Music is necessary for people's souls, and to be able to experience it live and let that just wash over you and be surrounded by it and be able to watch each instrument and see what they're doing, there's nothing like it in the world. It's just one of the most divine, I would say, spiritual experiences on this earth, really.
Well, having had the opportunity to sit here and talk with you for the last hour about all of this, I would love to have the opportunity one day to sit in one of your lectures and hear about all of these different aspects. It's just wonderful, and I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to share with us. I want to remind our listeners, too, you have a website, ericaminor.com, where they can find out more about you, as well as your books, your screenplays, as well as events. Maybe you're coming to their area sometime soon. So, again, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, Richard. Thank you.
And again, ericaminor.com is the website, and we encourage you to check out her website and find out maybe if she is coming to your area. Go listen to her talk. We'd love to encourage you to do that. Until next Saturday at this same time, this is Tell Me Your Story. I'm your host, Richard Dugan. Love to law.